Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 145, A Psychoanalyst's View of HBO's In Treatment, March 28, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional. So I wasn't initially disturbed. Okay, he's got a home office. I was kind of okay with that. But having
Shall we talk about the bathroom?
Yes, that's where I'm going. Having a bathroom that's right there, you know, where you can hear bathroom sounds and so on. I mean, that would be very difficult for the patient, I would think.
I would say very difficult for the patient. And, I mean, perhaps they did it for dramatic reasons, although somebody commented, and I think it was Glenn Gabber, but it's true. He said the patients, Paul's patients, have gone to the bathroom more than he's ever had a patient go to the bathroom in 30 years of treatment. And I think that's true. I've had, in all my years of practice, I've had two patients have to interrupt the session to go to the bathroom. And it usually, you know, when they come back, is connected to something that's going on.
What you've just heard is a snippet of my conversation about HBO's provocative series In Treatment with psychoanalyst Fern W. Cohen. You'll recall from last week's episode that Fern W. Cohen, Ph.D., is a psychoanalyst and psychotherapist in private practice in New York City, who's long been committed to conveying in everyday language what the psychoanalytic process is about and how it works. And she's also the author of the 2007 book, From Both Sides of the Couch, Reflections of a Psychoanalyst, Daughter, Tennis Player, and Other Selves. She's a graduate of Radcliffe College, and she earned her Ph.D. in school psychology from New York University and completed her analytic training at the NYU postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, as well as the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, of which she is a member. Now here's the interview. Dr. Fern Cohen, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back.
It's wonderful to have you back here. And we're going to talk about the HBO series In Treatment. And these episodes are fictional, yet they appear, in my opinion, they kind of give us a front row seat into the psychotherapy relationship. And so there are a lot of different angles that we can discuss this from. Let me start out by just asking you what, just sort of briefly, because we'll drill down in more detail,
okay,
but in a global kind of way, what was your initial reaction to the first few weeks?
Well, my initial reaction even precedes the first few weeks, which has to do with my excitement, and I think a lot of my colleagues, that finally there was going to be an attempt to capture what happens in the psychotherapy process. And I'd say that overall, despite the fact that I have quarrels with some of the material from a lot of different perspectives, I still think it is very exciting to have psychotherapy introduced, exposed, much closer to what really goes on.
Yeah.
For all the strengths and weaknesses.
Okay. And maybe just briefly, because I know that your reaction to it changed kind of in later episodes. So maybe you could just kind of briefly characterize what your more recent reaction has been.
You want me to talk about the more recent one?
Yeah, just kind of your global reaction. I know you have said to me that you thought that it veered off in kind of a soap opera direction that was less true to psychotherapy.
Well, I've sort of come back because I have, like many of my colleagues, and actually we had NYU postdoc, the Analytic Institute that I graduated from, actually had a salon for us analysts to talk about our reactions to the program.
Fascinating.
Which was way back when, and I'm among the many who became immediately addicted.
Me too.
And, I don't know whether you have been. But,
yes.
Yeah. And I, as with an addiction, I hadn't really thought of it this way, I've gone through cycles. I was excited, and overall, I still am very happy that there is a series trying to do what they do. Middle section, I became somewhat unhappy with what I saw as deviations from an appropriate therapeutic process. Nothing major, but notable. And now, with some of the characters really having resolved or getting closer to resolving the issues, I am really feeling much more positive again. So I'm going through cycles, and maybe not unlike the way somebody experiences a psychotherapy.
Interesting. And by the way, I should let our listeners know that we're going to try to avoid spoilers. I know sometimes I've listened to, sometimes I'll turn off movie reviews that come on the radio or on TV, because particularly some reviewers go way into the plot, and I like to be surprised when I go to the movies. I don't want to know the whole plot in advance. And so we're going to try, do our best to talk about this without getting into sort of some of the major plot twists and turns as much as we can, so that if there are listeners who haven't had a chance to see this series yet but hope to in the future, we're going to try not to spoil it for you. In fact, we hope to tantalize you and get you interested so you can share our addiction.
I'll try to behave myself.
Okay. Okay. Now, I know one of those analytic groups that you went to, you mentioned, this is based on a series that was very successful in Israel. Did you tell me that they actually showed one or more episodes of the Israeli version with English subtitles?
You know, they did. They showed the whole first week, and unfortunately, I didn't make it to that symposium,
oh.
So I have not seen it. But I've heard people who have seen it and who are also in the field talk about it, and everybody has commented that there's a huge cultural difference that has an impact on the way we see it or experience it. Like one of the issues throughout the series is the issues of boundaries, you know, where,
yes,
how the therapist maintains his sense of privacy about himself, or how the therapist maintains the structure of the treatment by ending and starting on time or handling money.
Right.
And I gather those are looser in Israel. And the whole issue in Israel from a cultural perspective is about boundaries. So in some ways, and which I can't really discuss more because I haven't seen it, it apparently has a big difference on the exchanges that go on, even though the dialogue, as I understand it, was really copied. I mean, they didn't change the particular characters who are in therapy. They didn't change the character or the conflict of the therapist, you know, Paul. And so they lifted it from a culture where some of the underlying issues that the characters or the patients struggle with are somewhat different. But again, I think until we all might have a chance to see the Israeli version, it would be hard to do a comparison.
Well, I'm hoping that we do get that opportunity. I have a listener in Israel, and I've put a bug in his ear, and he's kind of poking around, seeing if he can find a way maybe for us to get a copy of that. I know one issue is that they have different DVD formats in that part of the world.
Yeah.
So how we'll ever transcend that, I don't know. But if anybody's listening to this show and has access to the English version and maybe has a way to put it on a server where I could download it, I mean the Israeli version, and has some way that we could take a look at that. I'd sure appreciate the opportunity to compare it. I really appreciate the background that you've just given us, Fern, on this cultural difference, because I know you and I were both having some pretty strong reactions to some of the boundary issues as they were portrayed in the series. And also, I would think, you know, in the American series, for example, one of the patients, Alex, is a Air Force pilot. I would imagine that in the Israeli series, he probably is in the Israeli forces, you know, rather than the American forces.
Yeah, and that makes a huge difference because Israeli pilots are really the heroes of the Army and of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the pilot, I don't know how much you want me to give away.
Not
but
too much.
I think, you know, his loss of idealism comes across in a much more compelling way than the American pilot, Alex, who also has a kind of mistake, which, you know, he's left actually not feeling guilt, which becomes the whole or a major focal point of the treatment. So I think it's there's probably a more striking example of where the cultural difference, not that our soldiers aren't heroes, and we certainly have an army fighting you know, in a war with all kinds of civilian casualties, but I think it's our army is not the same as the Israeli army, you know, is so central to their culture and sense of being.
Yes. Before I forget to, and I wish I had thought to mention this earlier, if anybody is listening to this and has not had a chance to see any of the episodes, let me alert you that the first 3 weeks, the five episodes come out every week for 9 weeks, and I think right now we're in either the seventh or the eighth week. Well, the first 3 weeks are available for free on iTunes. If you go to the iTunes store and you do a search there for In Treatment, you can listen to the first 15 episodes for free, download them, listen to them on your computer or on an MP3 device. Now, I recently saw the actor Gabriel Byrne, who does a wonderful job, I think, of playing Paul, the therapist, and was intrigued to learn on the Charlie Rose interview that he's never been in therapy himself.
Well, he certainly, you know, with some criticisms, I certainly think he captures so much of a therapeutic stance. I mean, one of the things that's really impressed me is his listening.
Yes.
And the way in which, and I think, you know, patients so often have trouble with silence. And he really is able to sit and listen with the understanding that I think they probably shorten some of the pauses because it is on TV and you can't have too long a pause. He also helps almost everybody discover something about himself or herself that he or she didn't know before. And I think that is, you know, from my way of thinking, one of the crucial things that one tries to do as a therapist. And sometimes I think he talks too much about himself, and I think he doesn't really draw people out enough before he makes an interpretation, but I think that's probably more about the limits of the time, you know, the actual television time.
Yeah, the whole process, in many ways, the process feels true to life, but typically therapy wouldn't move as fast as it moves in this series. The insights and the breakthroughs and the interpretations are, I think, on a faster track than might be typical.
Faster, and from my perspective as a psychoanalyst who sees people 3 and 4 times a week when I can, not once a week. I think it's very hard to achieve that level. This is now I'm talking about the reality as opposed to the TV. I think it's very hard, you know, to achieve that level of depth and to sustain it, you know, coming once a week, because there's something about the frequency that allows people you know, whose defenses are beginning to come down to stay with something as opposed to build them right back up again.
Well, let's say something about that. You're a Freudian psychoanalyst, so maybe we should start by having you give us a reasonably succinct, which you really you sort of just done, overview of the differences between a formal psychoanalysis and what's called psychodynamic or psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapy. Just give us a thumbnail sketch of the distinction between those two.
I have two reactions. The first one is, you've got to be kidding. And the second one is, well, maybe people will also read my book, because I do hope that I've clarified some of the differences, but I'll try some now. One of the big differences, assuming that we're talking about psychodynamic, which means having to deal with unconscious mind, unconscious conflict, and trying to make people more aware of the forces inside them that are operating that they're not aware of. The big difference, although you can get a bunch of analysts and you'll get a number of different responses, the big difference is the frequency. Not because of the sake of the frequency, but because it fosters what we call a regression, meaning allowing people to really get back to things that they have been covering up or aren't aware of, and coming back the next day and picking it up again or staying with it, as opposed to picking themselves up, going out in the world, getting caught up in their daily lives and getting away from something that they don't want to know about. Because it's usually stuff that's painful or frightening or, you know, that we're very conflicted about. So who wants to know about that?
Yeah.
There's one other big difference. I think the greater frequency also fosters what we call transference to the analyst or the therapist. While we all have transferences all the time, you know, to people who remind us of a parent or a sibling and often react to them in that way, when it's when the process is so ongoing as an analysis, the transference really gets focused on the analyst and then creates an opportunity in what's going on between the analyst and the analysand to take a look at it and find out where it's really coming from.
Yes, and another distinction that you didn't mention is, the at least in traditional Freudian psychoanalysis, would be the use of the couch.
Yes, yeah.
So to just sort of review this then, in a strict traditional analysis, we have somebody who's going four or five times a week. They're on a couch in which they can't really see the face of the analyst most of the time. And this creates almost a kind of emotional pressure cooker, if you will, in which the intensity is really amped up quite a bit from other sorts of psychotherapy for the most part, because of this frequency and because of not being able to see the analyst. It sort of invites all sorts of unconscious material and projections. On the other hand, we have the what's called psychodynamically oriented psychotherapy, where the therapist subscribes to many of the same underlying beliefs about personality dynamics and the structure of personality, but they're seeing people less frequently, and it tends to be face-to-face, usually once a week, and it's face-to-face. So given all of that background, from what school of thought would you say that Paul is practicing?
It's hard for me to tell. I just want to backtrack a little bit. You said Freudian, but Freudian means contemporary Freudian, which is very different from what happened to Freudian classical analysis in America, you know, in the 50s and 60s, when it was a quite one-way process, and one never really had the sense of the analyst as a participant in a two-way process.
Yeah, and we covered that in our previous interview, so you don't need to go into that.
Okay, that's right. What was the question? I sidetracked myself.
Well, I think you were just going to make that comment, which I've just kind of...
But where I consider myself is... I don't consider myself an interpersonal, but I certainly think, and most contemporary Freudians do see it as a two-way process with a contribution that comes from the analyst that's not just making interpretations.
Okay, and I need to remind you to move the phone a little bit away from your mouth.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
And so I notice, as I'm sure you noticed, that there are references in the show, particularly when Paul is meeting with his supervisor, Gina, and there are references to the Institute. Mm. And to me, this suggests there is this implication that he is a graduate of a psychoanalytic institute, even though in no way is there ever any reference to theory. What's your take on that?
I think that was definitely the suggestion that he graduated from an institute. You have no idea what kind. And I thought I heard in one program somebody refer to him as a psychiatrist. I heard he referred to himself in another as a psychologist. So it's never quite clear whether he's a PhD doctor or an MD doctor. I think it's safe to assume that it was an analytic institute, but you don't know any more than that, except that there was some kind of a, you know, conflict between him and Gina, and I think, unfortunately, analytic institutes can be rife with conflict,
yes.
Sibling rivalry, all kinds of stuff, unfortunately, but I think it's definitely a facet of analytic training sometimes.
And that's one of the interesting aspects of the show, I think, that probably most people might not key into quite as much as you and I would, that sort of insider's view of how that world can in some ways be a bit incestuous or a bit, you know, a bit closed in.
Extremely.
Extremely. You've been there.
But it's also not clear. I mean, it is one of the things about the show that I'm having the most difficulty with, or I certainly was in the beginning. You don't really know whether it's supervision that he's having with Gina, mm-hmm. whether it's therapy. And it was quite brutal kind of supervision. And I know I've been reading a lot of the comments. One of my listservs, people have been writing about the show, and I've actually been accumulating them. And, you know, several people have said, and I certainly feel that way myself, I've never had an experience that was so confrontational in supervision, and I wouldn't have stayed with the supervisor. So it could conceivably happen in the therapy, but it isn't. I think they're very fuzzy about what that is.
Yeah, it's one of the places where the whole question of boundary issues comes up, mm-hmm. isn't it? Because they're not clear. There's not a clear definition, and there haven't really been clear boundaries set on just what their relationship is. And it sounds like in the past they had a kind of a personal relationship. Also, I think there's the implication that she had perhaps been a supervisor in the past. Also, that there had been conflict between them in the past, and yet he comes to her now looking for something, and it's not clear to what extent he's looking for therapy. In fact, it becomes couples therapy for a while.
I don't know whether you've seen the last, but it definitely has become couples therapy.
Yes.
And I don't know how much you want me to give away. He is so obnoxious in the beginning of those supervisory sessions. But I think that, to me, that's one of the great weaknesses, because it really doesn't convey to the public how helpful a supervisory process can be. And because there's so much, I mean, one thing that I think, you know, people who aren't doing it are not aware of, you're really very much alone with a patient. And we really never know what's going on with anybody else's work. So it's really important to be able to talk about one's work and have a sounding board. And that aspect, whether it's personal or some conflict with a patient that one can't make sense of, And that doesn't really come across. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but I think they do a lot of other things. They capture a lot of other things. But it's one of the weak parts for me.
Yeah, I come at it from a little bit of a different angle, although I definitely take your point and can see where you're coming from. I think in a way it's overdrawn. But the part that fascinates me is, and part that seems very realistic, although again compressed in terms of time and so on, is that each of Paul's patients attack him in various ways. Mm-hmm. You know, they complain about the time boundaries, they complain about the money, they complain that he's uptight, that he won't accept their gifts. I'm sure you can come up with other examples, but sometimes they're very frontal and very outspoken, you know, in their criticisms of him. And one of the things I admire about the way that he's portrayed is he's pretty deft at not being defensive and just kind of sitting there and absorbing it and responding in some way, but kind of with a nice kind of jujitsu, if you will. But what's interesting then is when he goes to see Gina, he does the same thing. And and he's as blind to his issues as his clients are to their issues. And the part that seems really overdrawn to me is that he is so blind. It's hard to believe that a therapist with as much experience and as much training as he has could be quite that blind to his issues.
I agree with you. I mean, it isn't just that he had training. It meant that he would have had to have had his own analysis. And to be, I think blind is the right word, that he really seems so out of touch. He also has this kind of transformation when he's relating to his wife. He's aggressive. He's distant. He seems completely out of touch with that and completely oblivious about what makes her tick. Now, I do remember once when I was just beginning analytic training, one of my instructors was talking to the group and said, remember that we're supposed to be experts in the problems of living. It doesn't mean we're necessarily experts in living. And I think, you know, it's a valid point. But I do think presumably somebody who has been as well trained as Paul would have a better grip on some of what's going on inside him.
Yeah, I think it's overdrawn. You know, there is this popular stereotype that shrinks are screwed up, that all shrink, and that's why they become shrinks in the first place, et cetera. And, you know, there is certainly a grain of truth in there somewhere, but I think it's overdrawn here. It does make the point, the valid point, that shrinks have their own issues and they have their own blind spots, but it's just kind of overdrawn.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with you about it. I mean, I think that's probably where the whole issue of it being a drama.
Yes.
I think they probably had to make things more extreme.
Yes.
Just as I think the illustration of the patient's resistance and aggression. I mean, I have had resistant patients and I've had aggressive patients, but to have that amount of resistance with every patient, I think that's really a bad dramatic effect.
Yes, I agree. Now, we were talking about supervision and popped into my mind The Sopranos. Did you watch The Sopranos at all?
Yes, most of it.
Okay, so you know that there was the therapist there, and there was also her supervisor, Elliot. So how would we somehow this to me is a much more compelling portrayal of a therapist than she was. Would you agree or not?
Completely. I mean, I always thought I was in the minority. A lot of analysts and including Glenn Gabbard, who's a very established and reputable analyst, has written a book about psychotherapy and The Sopranos. And many analysts were so excited by Dr. Malfi that they actually gave Lorraine Bracco an award at one of the analytic conventions. which I think is nuts. I just think, you know, she certainly captured elements of psychotherapy that wasn't a caricature, that wasn't, you know, a gross distortion. But I thought, you know, she was adequate, and I thought her supervision wasn't supervision. It's like she was meeting an old friend and talking, but not really exploring her countertransference and some of the issues. And at the end, I mean, it was a disaster how they ended it, because she, somebody gave her a book to read about sociopaths being untreatable, and the next time she saw Tony, she ended the treatment, which was unethical.
Yes.
And as if suddenly she had this conversion, and as if she didn't know what she was doing all along. So I thought it certainly was a better portrayal compared to caricatures and, you know, grotesque boundary violations. But I think this is light years. I think the treatment is light years, you know, beyond that.
Yes, you know, I hearkening back to that Charlie Rose interview in which I said that we found out that Gabriel Byrne had not been in therapy, but you commented on how well he seems to portray the act of listening. And when he was asked how he prepared for this role, he said he went and studied really good listeners. So he watched old episodes of Dick Cavett, for example, who was a wonderful listener. And he also said that the current presidential debates were a great place to watch people listening, because when you're in a debate for the presidency, you're really listening to your opponent, you know, so that you'll be able to seize upon the issues. So that's how he prepared. I have to think, though, you know, at first when I heard that, I thought, how could he not have been in therapy and been doing such a good job? But then I realized, well, maybe the heavy lifting, in a way, has been done by the writers.
Yes.
So I don't know if you know, but I'm guessing that somebody among the writers had to have been in therapy.
One of them, and I don't know which one, is the child of analyst parents. So, uh-huh. But I'm sure at least one of them was in therapy, and I'm sure they had, you know, a therapist as a consultant. I wish I remembered the particulars, but I'm sure that at least one of them is very familiar with, you know, that universe.
Yeah, there's just too much insider information is so accurately reflected. Now, let's get into the boundary issues some, because I know we both had issues around that. And I know you referred me to an article that was in the New York Times relating to the whole issue of therapists' offices in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, and I guess there's a whole big discussion dialogue about that. I know that years ago, in addition to being a professor, I was also doing part-time psychotherapy, and I did have an office in my home. So, you know, I know something about that. Let's talk a little bit about that, the pros and the cons, and maybe where you stand on that issue.
Well, as I said someplace in my book, get three analysts together on a particular issue or a question, and you'll get three different opinions. So,
okay.
I'll start with that. I mean, my personal preference is to have an office that's separate from the home. I sometimes joke as my office as a home away from home, but that's because it's a very comfortable space, and that's very important to me. But I think it makes it so much harder if you have an office in a home setting the way Paul does, the therapist, because there are all these personal details around pictures, instances of his hobbies, what he likes to read. And while, you know, in theory and in practice, one tries to analyze anything that a patient, you know, starts to ask about or wonder about, I think the more the reality is introduced, the harder it is to get at the patient's fantasy about the analyst. So I would, you know, my preference would be, it could be whatever kind of office one likes and feels comfortable in, but it does provide a more neutral setting. And I don't mean bland, but I do think neutral is, perhaps the word that captures it best.
Yes. Well, what you're saying makes a lot of sense to me, especially for some form of traditional psychoanalysis, where it is that pressure cooker environment and where the therapist is particularly wanting to invite unconscious material.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe it's less of an issue for once-a-week therapy that maybe isn't quite as focused on that invitation of unconscious material. But one of the things that... So I wasn't initially disturbed. Okay, he's got a home office. I was kind of okay with that. But having...
Shall we talk about the bathroom?
Yes, that's where I'm going. Having a bathroom that's right there, you know, where you can hear bathroom sounds and so on. I mean, that would be very difficult for the patient, I would think.
I would think very difficult for the patient. And, perhaps they did it for dramatic reasons, although somebody commented, and I think it was Glenn Gabbert, but it's true. He said the patients, Paul's patients, have gone to the bathroom more than he's ever had a patient go to the bathroom in 30 years of treatment. And I think that's true. I've had, in all my years of practice, I've had two patients have to interrupt the session to go to the bathroom. And it usually, you know, when they come back, is connected to something that's going on. I mean, you can't always nail it in the moment. But usually they're, you know, it's a kind of acting out or a release of pressure. So to have that as part of the therapeutic setting, maybe they did it for reasons of drama.
Yeah, because also there are things, you know, we see one of the characters go in and open up the medicine cabinet and kind of look at, you know, what's in there, which, you know,
right. Mm-hmm.
to get a read on, okay, what's he taking? And
one of the characters does something more drastic,
yes.
But you don't want me to give that away.
Right. And so that the fact that that sort of stuff would be available in such a bathroom also seemed a bit unrealistic.
The other thing, but along those lines, on a, you know, more mild version, but still the same kind of excess, is to serve coffee, to serve water, to have a coffee machine there. And, you know, in one of the very early sessions, he gets up to put a blanket, you know, around the patient.
Yes.
And those are all gestures which could be seductive, intrusive. I mean, there's a whole range of possibilities. So I think it's, you know, I would argue for more abstinence in those areas because you're going to get to that material, but you want it to come from the patient, not because it's stimulated by what the therapist does or doesn't do.
Yes. Now, you're in New York, and I'm in California.
Right.
And so there's
and
some...
I'm sure there are style differences.
Yeah, there are some real differences, I think. Not that there aren't analysts in California, but there is a real sort of difference between, there's a big continuum, I think, you know, with formal analysis on one end and new age therapies, mm-hmm. if you will, on the other end. And certainly I know therapists, there are probably lots of therapists, not just in California, who would offer a blanket, Kleenex, coffee, hugs, and various other things. So, you know, there is quite a bit of variability, as you point out. And there are also real risks. You know, we talk, mm-hmm. one of the things that this show underscores is sort of the seductiveness and the danger of what's called counter-transference. And here we have an instance of, and hopefully this isn't too much of a spoiler, but one of the female characters comes on very bluntly and very strongly to the therapist, trying to seduce him into a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And he appears to waver and perhaps goes too far in terms of being open about his counter-transference. To the show's credit, and I imagine that's shocking. There are aspects of that are shocking and maybe seem accurate, inaccurate. But I have to note, here in California, we have a newsletter that comes out from the licensing board, and it lists the ethical violations and whose licenses have been yanked and for what. It's like being pilloried in public, and yeah. I can tell you that it's kind of shocking to see the number of people who are having their licenses suspended or yanked altogether because of sexual violations of one sort or another, boundary violations.
I have heard, you know, and there's a part of me that I think is still naive and believing that, you know, somebody who's trained is going to uphold ethical standards, but I have heard it is more prevalent than, you know, anybody would like to acknowledge. So I think that's, you know, that's really an unfortunate aspect. I also think, but I have no idea about the statistics, a lot of people don't know what training people should have in order to be a therapist. And I'm assuming if these are people who are licensed, they've certainly gotten at least a degree.
Yes.
But, and not that, you know, more intensive training is a guarantee, but I do think a lot of people don't have more training and then set up shop. And I think if they haven't had their own at least intense therapy or analysis, it's much easier, I think, to fudge the boundaries or to find rationalizations. Not that I think there's any justification for it ever.
Right, right.
But I did, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was actually going to switch back to something else if there's a thought you wanted to finish up.
Well, it was just a thought about the blanket because actually okay. I had an article just published in a journal called the Candidate Journal, which is a new online journal written primarily by or for candidates in analytic training. And this was an article I wrote when I was in training and then rewrote for this journal. The title is To Say or Not to Say, To Do or Not to Do. And I describe my struggle whether to offer a blanket to a patient because the office was very cold. But I do it in the context of a treatment of a patient who was a very difficult patient and very troubled. And it's about where the relationship and the therapy had brought both of us. So even though I consider myself a purist, or mm-hmm. would like to be,
yeah.
It was a very important moment in her treatment, maybe more for me than her, but I do think always the bottom line is to try to understand, you know, why you've done something or haven't said something when you're the therapist, because you are human and we have all the, you know, conflicts and issues that go with it.
Yes. 2 points I want to touch on. One is to go back to the sort of degree to which Paul is sometimes overdrawn in his blindness, and that's in relation to one of the recent episodes I saw where he was dealing with his own kids, and he was just so, he was so crippled in terms mm-hmm. of his ability to speak to them and to speak to their needs and so on. And again, that seemed, it just seemed too extreme for somebody of his training and sophistication and degree of caring and so on.
Well, I have to wonder, we'll never know this. I assume that that's the dramatic effect.
Sure.
Because I agree with you that not only that, I think the whole, and I don't think we're letting the cat out of the bag, the whole erotic transference, that was the first session of the whole program. And, of course, that's what everybody always jokes about, you know, patients fall in love with or try to seduce their therapist. And that's at one extreme of the spectrum. And also, he could not have been so blind to have had her in treatment for a whole year. and not to have been aware of, you know, the messages she was sending. So from my perspective, that was unfortunate. I would have loved for them to have started with something less extreme. And I think as a practicing informed therapist, he would have been well aware of that and would have been establishing boundaries instead of, loosening them as getting up and offering her a blanket. I mean, that's a seductive gesture.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot of, when I was thinking about our, you know, conversation about the treatment, I think one of the things about the show that is really remarkable and I think will allow lots of people to continue to think and talk about it is you could look at it from a whole variety of perspectives, you know, from the treatment process, from what it suggests about issues about boundaries. Lots of people could discuss each session from the perspective mm-hmm. of a supervisor.
Yes.
And find something wrong with it or something right with it. But it's very rich.
Yes.
And I think it accomplishes a great deal just by virtue of being so rich.
Yes, I was thinking about our conversation. You know, I realized that, ideally we would be watching it together and we could stop it and pause and comment on this part or that part.
Yeah.
And so as I listen to what you're saying now, I'm realizing that, you know, this could actually be used as a training tool, I would think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, with a class dealing with these kinds of issues, and one could key into issues of transference, countertransference, resistance,
mm-hmm.
and it could generate a lot of good material for discussion.
Yeah, I teach occasionally teach a course I taught last fall, Theories and Methods of Psychotherapy. And I certainly, if I teach the course again, I would certainly use, you know, elements of the treatment, because there isn't a lot of good visual stuff around.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very hard to actually be in a therapy session.
Right.
Or be the observer.
I commented earlier about the kinds of resistance things that were being thrown up at Paul by each of the people,
mm-hmm.
and also commented on how the five-day-a-week setup really creates kind of an emotional pressure cooker that's hard for people who've never been in that sort of situation to understand how people could get so carried away, so concerned by minutia. And I'm remembering by what might seem to an outsider like minutia. And so I'm remembering a story in your book where you talked about, and I think I'm trying to remember if this was for you as a client or you as the analyst. I think it's you as the analyst. Or maybe you had two different stories, both related to time, to coming 5 minutes early or 5 minutes late, something like that. And it was a big issue.
I think it was when I was in analysis and my analyst was 5 minutes late.
Okay. Yeah.
And he was had always been exactly on time, beginning or ending the hour. And one time he was five minutes late. And after the first minute, there was a little bit of surprise, and my surprise went to concern, and very quickly, anxiety, and then rage that he had kept me waiting. And, it really was all about transference and me having felt like the outside child who always had to wait or be on the outside of her important father's work. And he arrived, and he had me into the session, and I do describe this in the book because there's a good reason he did not apologize. And the rest of the session was about my rage and how in the transference he had become my distant father who was too preoccupied with his work. And that's how transference works, and it's about exposing those things and working them through, that's a very sort of central element of the process.
Yeah, I thought it was a wonderful illustration of, as I say, from the outside, somebody might say, 5 minutes late, come on, give the guy a break.
Right.
But in the context of this sort of very intense five times a week relationship where everything about your childhood is being stirred up and it's activating old childhood conflicts about your father and so on, it assumes enormous, enormous importance. And then brings it into the room, brings the past into the room in a very present way that the two of you can work through.
That's what is part of what, you know, when we use the term regression.
Yes.
And, you know, as I said in the book, had he arrived and said, I'm sorry, and told me why, or just said, I'm sorry, I would have accepted his apologies and gotten into the session, and probably we would have gotten to, I might have been annoyed, but the fact that he didn't and that he let me play it out, that's what's supposed to happen in a treatment.
And that takes a lot of training. I think, you know, my own reflex would be to apologize.
Yeah.
And I think that would be the reflex of most therapists, and it's one of the things that distinguishes, I think, the kind of the somebody who's really practicing a psychoanalytic approach is willing to take that stand and risk of not doing the polite expected thing.
Right. Yeah, and allowing the anger or whatever else, you know, you're going to be the object of.
Yeah, and as we begin to wrap this up here, because I'm aware of the time and we probably should begin to wrap it up, I think one of the things that Paul does really well, as he is depicted, is somehow he manages to keep the pressure up, the intensity. There is a kind of intensity in each session, and people will ask him to back off, and he does back off. He's responsive, but somehow he ends up coming back around in a way that kind of keeps them on point. I've been impressed by that.
Yeah, no, I have, too. One thing I want to say before we wrap up, that the acting is superb. I mean, the young woman
yes.
who plays Sophie the adolescent is just, she is so compelling, but all of them, but the acting is just above and beyond, it seems to me.
I totally agree. Well, I really want to thank you for coming back on the show again and being willing to engage in this discussion with me, and clearly we could go on and on.
My fantasy is we'll have a little series.
Yeah, well, that could be my fantasy as well, so don't be surprised if I call on you for other things here. So, Dr. Fern Cohen, thanks for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, and thank you for having me. It really has been fun and an opportunity.
It was great fun for me to have such an interactive discussion with an analyst of Fern's stature. If you haven't had a chance to catch In Treatment, I hope you'll do so before it disappears from the scene. You may note that Fern Cohen's doctorate degree is a PhD in school psychology. In her book, she says that it used to be the case that you had to have an MD to get into a psychoanalytic training institute in this country. She reports that that situation has completely reversed and that currently most of the candidates in training in analytic institutes come from psychology or social work. So just in case any of you out there are therapists with an analytic inclination, I thought that might be useful information for you. Part of the reason I'm able to converse fluently about psychoanalytic practice is that my own doctoral program in clinical psychology at the University of Michigan was very psychoanalytic at the time that I studied there. I have to say I was completely turned off to what seemed to me at the time to be an overly pathologizing, paternalistic, and even authoritarian feeling approach. I don't think my perceptions were altogether unfounded, but I also now recognize that in part my rejection had elements of youthful rebellion and perhaps resistance. It was the mid-60s, after all. However, more of that training stuck than I would have guessed, and I do find value in the ways that the psychoanalytic approach has developed in the years since. It's also been interesting to me to see that a number of therapists I've known who started off in Gestalt or some other, quotes, more modern approach, later sought out analysis or analytic training for themselves as they matured and or wished to get a deeper understanding of themselves and unconscious processes.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Well, it's now been about a week after the interview that you've just heard with Dr. Fern Cohen, and In Treatment is in its last week with some big surprises in the final episodes. I think I have just one more episode to watch. I'm going to miss this series. You might want to check out my other podcast series at www.wisecounselpodcast.com, where I have a new interview with a Shrink Wrap Radio listener who also happens to be an author and a Toronto-based psychotherapist. Her name is Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, and she's produced a very well-written, authoritative book titled Raise Your Kids Without Raising Your Voice. And the interview is packed with great tips for parents, so check it out. I'm still hoping to hear from listeners who might be in or near Barcelona. I'll be there for 8 days in May and would love to get together with one or more listeners over a Spanish hot chocolate. As always, sponsors for this show are Podshow and GoDaddy. Thanks to all of you who've bought domain names and such at GoDaddy and used the discount codes on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. For example, the code SHRINK3 will save you 10% on your next domain name purchase at checkout.
Anyway, hi, Dr. Dave. This is Joni, a.k.a. Honey Rococo from Berkeley, and I thought I would finally call you and say hi, and thanks for a great podcast. I never miss a show, and I'm really, really appreciative that you take such time and care to create such an interesting show and to find such good guests and do such really thoughtful interviews. So thanks for that. But in other news, I really hate to tell you this, but I think that Frapper map is dead. Months ago, I tried to add myself when I was living in Paris, and it just didn't take. And that was about the time that you began your long string of laments about the lack of new Frapper mapsters. And so I think either it must have become full or else the software went kaput, something like that. C'est la vie, I guess. And I'll also say congratulations on your new granddaughter. That's really exciting. And I hope that you're enjoying the spring and the beautiful spring here in the Bay Area and how spoiled and lucky we are with our good weather. And that's all because I'm really, really bad at leaving messages. Take care. Bye.
Thanks, Joni, for leaving that message on our voice line at 206-337-0622. It's so wonderful to finally actually hear your voice. If you take a look at the show comments on our website, you'll see a number of brilliant observations by Honey Rococo, who is, in fact, the Joni you just heard, a doctoral student in art history who divides her time between the San Francisco Bay Area and Paris. What a life. Yes, Joni, our Frapper map seems to be dead. I've heard from at least one other listener that they've tried putting themselves on the map and it just didn't work. I love seeing listeners scattered all around the globe, so if anyone knows of a good substitute for the Frapper map, please let me know. Oh, we've got time to catch up on just a few emails. Shane writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, I'm 28 years old and I live in St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada. I've been listening to your show for several months now. I especially like the episode on sand play. I found the whole concept fascinating. I write poetry and flash fiction." What's flash fiction? I'm not sure. "So I'm fascinated by play of various kinds since my creative process is a kind of play. The sand play episode reminded me of how I used to play with assorted figures and toys. I created a whole little world out of the remnants of different playsets. And when I had access to streams and ditches, I would make shipping lanes and dams. Of course, twigs, moss, and pebbles make great miniature villages. I was interested to hear Dr. Ravitz mention that the mind tries to heal itself whenever possible. For the record, I like the length of the show. Yeah, I frequently raise that question of whether it's too long or not. And it's signed Shane, who goes on to say, my nifty podcast, Yondercast, lives at www.yonderman.com. And I checked it out, and you might want to check it out as well. The next one comes from, it's F.R. Kirk. I assume F.R. refers to father. And he writes, Dr. Dave, I'm about to start a practice, but I'm somewhat unsure how to go about it. Maybe you could do a podcast on how to start a successful practice. Love both of your podcasts. They are a constant resource. Thanks, Father Kirk. Well, if in fact you're, first of all, let me say that I'm not sure I have enough people starting out in practices to justify devoting a whole show to that topic. So let me just say some things off the top of my head. Assuming that in fact you are a Roman Catholic father, one place to start would, of course, be using your ecclesiastical connections to let people know that you're going to be available. You also don't say a private practice of what, but I'm going to assume it's some kind of psychotherapy. So my tips are, first of all, develop a specialty if you don't already have one. In today's world, niche marketing rules, and that's true for psychotherapy, at least in my area where there are so many psychotherapists competing with one another. So having a specialty and becoming known for that specialty is very important. Also, let physicians and other referrers know. You can let other psychotherapists know your specialty as well. But particularly physicians, since they're not directly competing with you, and they've got people to refer out. Do lots of free public speaking about your specialty, and that will help get the word out. And of course, you want to have an office. You want to make sure that you get the proper licensing and that you get your insurance together. So those are my thoughts, and hope that gives you a little bit of a beginning. Finally, we hear from a listener in the heart of Mexico, who I believe has written before, because he says, hello, I'm writing you again to let you know I greatly appreciate the good work you're doing. I listen to this podcast and Wise Counsel. I listen to them every weekend on my car coming and going to my weekend home. I have to tell you that I consider both your shows as a great opportunity to keep well informed on themes related to psychology. In fact, I've purchased several of the books mentioned in the shows through Amazon, which is a great service for receiving books in my country, Mexico. I'm a psychotherapist living in Aguascalientes and San Miguel de Allende in the center of Mexico. I just write to let you know I really enjoy your work. Since I'm listening on my car, driving on the highway, and trying to make a note of the important information is a challenge. I know what you mean. That happens to me sometimes. He says, I would like to suggest that you send your loyal listeners a newsletter with a small resume and the important information of web page, email, and name of the book. The newsletter could also be a way to promote the shows. I hope you find this idea useful and of interest for others as well and not too time-consuming. I intend to keep on listening. Keep up the good work, Luis Antonio Marin. Luis Antonio, so good to hear from you again, and thank you for the suggestion of the newsletter. It is something I've thought about in the past, but it does seem like more work, and I just don't know that I've got the time or energy to add that bit more. I'll think about it, though. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows right in the comments area on the website. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, and you can also use the My Chingo button on our website to leave a voicemail, or using our phone voicemail like Joni did at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. Fern W. Cohen for dialoguing with me about HBOs in treatment. And I'm looking forward to possibly having future conversations with her here on Shrink Wrap Radio. I recently spoke to a psychology class on person in society at Sonoma State University. It was an interactive session between me and the students, which I recorded, and that will be next week's show. I'm hoping you'll find it interesting. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.